The meeting will come to order, and I think we have a quorum because the secretary just took the role, and that's what she tells me. So, Representative Seibert moves the minutes of March 15th. Is there any discussion about the minutes of March 15th? Seeing none, we need to order all those in favor of the minutes of March 15th, signified by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The minutes are adopted, and we move forward with the first item on the agenda, which is the Northside Commuter Rail, House File 3656, Representative Finkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Portman is a co-author on this bill, so I don't know if it's appropriate this time for her to make the motion that it would go to Civil Law Committee.
Mr. Chair, I so move.
All right. Remove House File 3656, passed as amended. As amended? Oh, we have an amendment here.
No.
Oh, we don't have an amendment. The scripts, you don't know how these scripts are going to come out.
You get a script?
I've seen Johnny Carson do the same thing. Oops. Pass and referred to Civil Law. Representative Timmelston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. This legislation has come together over the last week or so. You see the introduction date of March 16th, and it relates to commuter rail. As you know, I'm the chief author of the North Star Commuter Rail, and we're looking at issues as we get into the next level here with operations of that commuter rail line. And this, excuse me, House File 3656 allows the Commissioner of Transportation to contract with a railroad for commuter rail needs, and there's various technical things within this bill, and actually it will be going to civil law where some of those technical things will have additional review. And actually, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to acknowledge at this time of the work of various people over the last several days in reviewing this legislation and looking for some compromise amendments that might be necessary in the Civil Law Committee. I know we've been working with Organized Labor, Burlington Northern, the Trial Lawyers, and other groups. And so at this time, we feel that this is good language for this committee, and I just want to put it on record that we will be looking at an amendment in Civil Law, which specifically relates to civil law issues within this bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to turn it over to Cliff Green, who will go through the bill and answer technical questions related to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Clifford Green. I am an attorney and a negotiator on behalf of the NCDA and MnDOT in connection with developing commuter rail in cooperation with Burlington Northern. As you know, Burlington Northern owns a rail corridor and trackage that we want to be able to run commuter trains on, and our negotiations initially focused on capital improvements so that we could run the commuter trains without compromising Burlington Northern's freight operations. Since those early days, our focus of discussions has moved more to the question of operations, and when we have been looking at existing Minnesota law, we recognize that commuter rail is a new public transportation service not previously addressed by Minnesota law, and that it was thought to be in everyone's best interest to have a piece of simple legislation that clarified the legal status of commuter rail, especially in light of the fact that it is being provided and can only be provided with a collaborative relationship between the private freight railroad and the public operating authorities. So this particular piece of legislation does a couple of things, hopefully none of which will be terribly controversial. The first is it authorizes the acquisition of insurance. Under current discussions, we're planning on acquiring $200 million worth of insurance, which is consistent with the federal standards for set forth in a piece of legislation governing commuter rail liability. And insurance is very important here. That is the primary means that we have to control risk. So we're asking that this piece of legislation explicitly provide the operating entity with the authority to make this acquisition. In addition, we wanted to avoid any ambiguity or argument about what is the nature of the entity that's providing the services, because some of the property and some of the services for commuter rail may be contributed by Burlington Northern personnel working pursuant to a contract with the operating government entity. Some of it may be provided directly by the government entity, and we wanted to make sure that there was no ambiguity that when there was a liability scenario, it would be handled in the same way that it would be handled if the government providers were exclusively providing either the land, the equipment, or the service. This is a public service, and it is in our best interest to make sure that this potential area of ambiguity is clarified. I think that's really the essence of this particular legislation, except to say that it's modeled after another state's law. We checked into all of the states that have commuter rail, and all of them have, depending on their own particular legislative schemes, have enacted legislation addressing specifically commuter rail, and so we are doing that as well. And with that, hopefully brief and not too a complex explanation, I'd be happy to answer questions with respect to this particular piece of legislation.
The insurance is in favor of the railroad to protect the railroad against any liability.
It would ultimately it would protect all entities, but we would be the railroad's position is that we want to be protected so that by providing this particular service to the public, we are not subsidizing that through our own resources.
Okay, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tingle said, Mr. Green, not so much a question, just an observation as I read through this bill a few minutes ago for the first time. At line 1.9, it speaks of a commuter rail track as being an essential government function. Line 1.10, it speaks of the commuter rail as being a matter of public necessity, and I will tell you that while I recognize mass transit commuter rail may be an important public function, I do not know that I necessarily agree that it rises to the level of a matter of public necessity or an essential government function. As I read down, I get down into the area of lines 1.17. It says that the commissioner may contract with the railroad. It doesn't say Burlington Railroad. It says any railroad. The contract that the commissioner can enter into apparently can be made for the purpose of use of the railroad's right-of-way or the construction of rail track facilities or services. And when I think in terms of a contract with that kind of language given to the commissioner, it looks like a blank check to me. And I will tell you that I have the gravest of concerns given the kind of dollars that I have seen thrown around when we start talking about commuter rails. So those are just observations. I know that you're going to civil law from here, and would ask that you please keep in mind those comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, if I could comment briefly, and then perhaps Mr. Green has a comment. Appreciate your concerns with that, and actually your note about a blank check. The reason that this bill is coming together is because we want to make sure we don't have a blank check. So we want to put things in place that would avoid that through the process. But perhaps Mr. Green has a further description of something else with this language.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Green.
Representative Newman, thank you for your comments. In this particular statute, the term public necessity is more of a term of art than an expression of public policy. I think that from the standpoint of making it clear to any reviewing court going forward, it's important to point out that this particular enterprise is for the exclusive benefit of the public and not necessarily to make a policy statement with respect to sort of a gradation of need, so to speak. With respect to the question on blank check, as I understood it, the purpose of this is to provide authority to contract, but it's subject to all of the checks and balances that would be in place governing any contract. I don't believe it's the intent to exempt this particular authorized agency from those checks and balances, but rather to make it clear that they have authority to negotiate contracts as may happen in the future.
Mr. Chair. Representative Newman.
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Green, and to your explanation in terms of whether this is in a matter of public necessity or an essential government function. I think the statute says exactly what it says, and if your understanding is different from what it says, then I think it should be changed. That would be my suggestion. In terms of your comments regarding the contract, if there are checks and balances that are to be built into this legislation, then again, I think the legislation should so state, because what you, I would respectfully disagree that what you have related is not what this bill says insofar as that contract is concerned. It says that the commissioner may contract, but I don't see any limiting language, which would really give me great comfort if there was some in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I do appreciate your comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think that perhaps civil law will have a whack at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newman, I'd be happy to work with you between now and civil law, so let's talk further. Thank you.
Representative Hubbard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Green, I'm not sure what you're trying to accomplish here. For your statement, first of all, for my clarification, you said we're authorizing $2 million. Who's we? Who will purchase the $2 million policy?
It would be $200 million.
I'm sorry, $200 million.
It would ultimately be the contracting agency that is running the service for the government.
And, Mr. Chair, my understanding is MnDOT will be running this. Is that correct?
That's the current understanding, but it could be other entities depending. We're not making it specific. It's whoever's running the entity.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would like, along with Representative Newman, to make this specific, and I don't think we need our public entity contracting with the commissioner. If we're going to extend this type of right, I think that it should be somebody on a commissioner level that should be responsible. And considering the interaction with this project that I've seen with Met Council and other government entities, I'm not in any mood to provide this wide latitude of who's going to do this. I think the legislature needs to decide it, and as members of the Transportation Policy Committee, I think that we have a right to say that the Commissioner of Transportation be the one to do this, not some other government entity, in that this is setting a precedent for all commuter rail lines in the state. And right now, the Commissioner of Transportation has jurisdiction on the rail system in the state.
Well, Representative Homer, you might say that the Lieutenant Governor has is in charge as well.
Okay, well, that's just my point. And then the other question that I have is, what is your net result that you're trying to accomplish here? Are you trying to limit the liability of the rail company to the limits set forth for government entities so that in the case of an individual being injured on commuter rail, The liability limit would be, what is it, 300,000, is that correct? Is that your intent with this?
No, I don't believe, excuse me, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Representative Hoberg, I think the practical impact of this is to eliminate exposure for punitive damages for any of the entities that may be providing service. Government entities are not obligated to pay for punitive damages, and there would be an issue with respect to the ambiguity of if when a private entity acts as a government agent, is there exposure for those kinds of for the types of damages that the government entity wouldn't be exposed to. Because we're buying $200 million worth of insurance, and because there's a federal law that provides a $200 million damages cap in commuter rail accidents, it's not the intent of this legislation to affect what is sometimes called the liability caps. We do want to make clear that this would not be a situation where there would be inconsistent bases of liability exposure depending on whether you focused on the railroad's contribution or you focused on the public entity's contribution. For purposes of any incident or event occurring in connection with commuter rail, it would be one entity, and it would be adjudged as if it were a government entity. That would be the intent of this.
So if I might, for clarifying purposes, if there was some type of accident that was a result of gross negligence on the part of the railroad, they would have this benefit, if you will, of this reduced exposure by virtue of this insurance policy. Is that correct?
Mr. Green.
Mr. Chair, I think essentially you are correct in the sense that they would not be exposed for punitive damages beyond what the government entity would be exposed for, and since the government entity can't be sued for punitive damages, they cannot either.
So in other words, the net result of this is that if I was a cow traveling on a freight train on the same track, I would probably have much greater protection, or my owner would, through negligence on the behalf of the railroad that resulted in an accident than if I was a person. Is that correct?
Mr. Green.
I think the answer to that question is no. I'm not sure that I thought through the liability of the railroad for livestock damage and whether or not they can be exposed for punitive damages under those circumstances. But I can say that in a situation where the railroad is being asked to provide a public service, and the railroad is not in a position to charge more for the service if there's an accident tomorrow that drives their costs up, there's a need to be logical and consistent about what liability exposure will be, and this seems to be a very prudent approach and one followed in other states.
Maybe just for clarifying purposes, would you agree that because of the railroad would not be capped nor be exempt from punitive damages in the case of moving livestock or freight, that there's better protections for the owners of the livestock and or freight than there are for the individuals that ride as commuters?
Mr. Green.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, I don't agree with the hypothetical, but it's a more complex question about property damage and punitive damages, but I think that what I would say is this is an area that is subject to legislation. It's subject to federal legislation for commuter rail. And it's also an area that has been addressed by others before us, and they have addressed this issue in a similar manner in order to provide a public service, taking full advantage of the need for a public-private partnership. And I think that's as far as I can go on that subject.
All right, Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd like to make an oral amendment to this bill. On page 1, line 16, after the word commissioner, delete the comma, or public entity. And line 17, delete contracting with the commissioner, comma.
Mr. Chair. Over here.
Mr. Chair.
I heard the voice somewhere. Oh,
yeah.
Representative Newman.
Just direct your attention line 1.22. Representative Holberg is also referenced to a public entity. I don't know if that fits.
Mr. Chair, if I might also add, or a public entity on line 122 to be deleted as well. And thank you, Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair.
Oh,
yeah. Down here.
Oh, we're going back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm following some of this, Representative Holberg, but can you tell me on line 1.14 on existing language, where we've got the commissioner given the having authority to enter into a memo of understanding or agreement with a public or private entity, including the Regional Railroad Authority?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cox, and that's phrase, the commissioner is the one entering mm-hmm. into the contract. And if you go down to line 16 in the new language, they're giving the authority to a public entity contracting with the commissioner to do the May contract. And so what I'm trying to do here is that leave this responsibility and additional power only with the Commissioner of Transportation mm-hmm. and not MCDA, Anoka County, Met Council, Hennepin County, whoever. The commissioner is the one that has the responsibility for the railroads, and this is an expanded authority that I think should only be granted to the commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Holberg. I understand where you're going with this, but I would urge the committee to oppose this oral amendment because the way it's set up through current law was very specific that the commissioner wanted to have the authority to do this contract, and I think Mr. Green has some additional comments here.
Mr. Green?
Mr. Chair, this particular proposed legislation was intended to dovetail with existing legislation, which does indicate that the commissioner has authority to contract with public entities to discharge those public transportation functions. So the language was intended to mirror the language of existing legislation relating to the functions of the commissioner and the authority that the commissioner has to contract with other public entities. It was for that purpose that the language reads this way.
Any other questions or comments?
About
this amendment, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also encourage members to vote against it. This legislation is needed to move the North Star project forward, and it's going to civil law next, so there can be some adjustments in language in civil law, but I urge the committee to reject the amendment.
Anybody else?
Mr. Chair, point, this is the Transportation Policy Committee and has to do with who should get the authority, and the Commissioner of Transportation has the authority over the rail at this point, not other public entities.
Anybody else? You ready for a vote? And let's explain again what we're doing here. On line 1.16, after the commissioner or deleting a public entity, on line 1.17, or deleting contacting the commissioner, and on line 1.22, a domain or a public entity. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I think other than the comma following commissioner on line 16 as well.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Somebody
here from the agency
that
would like to just make a comment.
Mr. Chairman, Robert Barlin, assistant to the commissioner for MnDOT. With all due respect to my very good friend, Representative Holberg, who was carrying the governor's financing bill, by the way. yes. I would like to urge that the committee reject Representative Holberg's amendment. The commuter rail statute that governs commuter rail does give the Department of Transportation statutory authority over commuter rail, but as Mr. Green pointed out, that statute also references in a couple of locations the ability and the authority of the commissioner to contract with other government entities for the disposition of the duties in that statute. And this particular language dovetails with that language, so it is very clear that if the commissioner contracts with another authority for commuter rail operations, that authority will have the same responsibility, the same authority that the commissioner has. So it's really a matter of this legislation matching up with current statute that governs commuter rail, and we would appreciate the language staying as it is.
Representative Hubbard.
Mr. Chair and Mr. McFarland, is it the intent of MnDOT to contract with the Met Council for operation of this line to avoid liability issues?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hubbard, it may be the case that MnDOT contracts with the Metropolitan Council for operation of the line for any number of reasons, principally because the Met Council is a transit operating agency and the Department of Transportation is not, and that it would make very good sense, especially with the link that is envisioned between the North Star line and the Hiawatha line, and the kinds of efficiencies you could garner in that kind of a relationship. It is very possible that we'll be contracting with the Met Council for operating the commuter rail service, and that is, as I stated before, allowed and anticipated in current state law.
Representative Holberg, are you still...
No, Mr. Chair, I think it's far different to contract with a public entity to operate or provide service as opposed to when we're talking about liability and insurance issues.
Representative Steinberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Besides Met Council, could you give me an example of another public entity that might be contracted?
I suppose it is, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I suppose it is conceivable for whether it's this line or some other commuter rail line to contract with a county, with a joint powers board, mm-hmm. with even a private sector entity such as an entity similar that would run an opt-out bus service. I think that with the beauty of the commuter rail statute as it exists today is that while accountability to the Department of Transportation and the commissioner is very clear, there is flexibility in that statute for the commissioner to choose what the commissioner believes is the best model for the delivery of that particular service in whatever particular corridor might be in question.
Representative Horston, you had a question. Was it on this amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not on this amendment.
Is there anybody else that chooses to voice? Watch out. I see Representative Wilson lining up here. All right. We'll move to a vote then on... we don't have an amendment on it, but the oral amendment is given by Representative Harvey. Anybody have any questions on what we're voting on? All those in favor of deleting the aforementioned language, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I believe the rules have it.
Division.
All those in favor of the Hobart Amendment, please raise their hand. Six or seven. All those opposed to the Hobart Amendment, raise their hand.
Okay, Tori.
Okay. By the fact I have an ear infection, I still called that right. The Hobart Amendment is not adopted. We have then Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, I guess it would be for Mr. Green. On 1.19, there's reference to employees permitting. And I know there's a lot of complicated labor law as it relates to railroads.
Senator Russ, are you here in your official business? Or?
Just passing through.
Excuse me.
Something's going on in the northwest suburbs, I guess.
Yeah.
anyway, I'll just repeat that quickly, Mr. Chair. On 1.19, first page, line 19, there's reference to employees permitting, and I know there's a lot of complicated federal labor law as it relates to railroads, but I just wanted to make sure that there wouldn't be any diminution of, you know, railroad union organizing or workers' rights or anything like that in that language.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Green.
Representative Hornstein, that's correct. It's neither the purpose nor the effect of this legislation to alter existing rights under federal labor law protections or existing union contracts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hardin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hornstein, to that concern, I met with folks, employees of the railroad and the United Transportation Union with exactly the same concern, and that's the language that will be addressed in civil law with regard to FELA and employees' collective bargaining rights and contracting rights. And I've been assured that we will make absolutely clear that this doesn't impact employees' rights vis-a-vis their negotiations with Burlington Northern. And to return to the original point that Representative Holberg was making regarding the freight versus the people, you know, I co-authored this bill with Representative Tinglestad because of the fact that it makes sense to treat this mode of transportation like we do other modes of transportation in mass transit. If you're riding a bus, there's certain liability rules that apply to you. If you're on the light rail line, the Hiawatha line, there's certain liability rules that apply to you. And this bill just makes those same liability rules apply to you when you're riding North Star Commuter Rail as if you are on the Hiawatha or if you are on a Metro Transit bus. And so the labor concern is a real one that Representative Holmstein brought up, but I think that all the folks who are involved in this amendment or in this bill are going to address that in civil law.
Are there other questions or comments? Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tinglestad, I'm just curious about the first page, lines 8 through 10, where it talks about the planning, development, construction. It looks like lines 10 through 12 say the same thing. I mean, do we need to say that it's public necessity? I mean, it looks redundant to me, but am I missing something?
Check it out
for
just
a second. You mean all afternoon he's been in? Can't we stop? I don't know what the question was. It's all right.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ruth, we're conferring on that. It's our understanding that that language is needed, but we will be checking on it before it goes to the next committee, and I think it relates to Representative Newman's question earlier as well. So the sentences are different. One talks about responsibility and one talks about the public necessity, so we'll be checking in with that. You know, this is modeled after another state, so thanks for bringing that to our attention.
Are there other questions or comments? Are you going to refer that to some other time and Representative Wood? Is that what you're planning? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll be working with Representative Newman and others to fine-tune this as it gets to the next committee. Some of these issues are related specifically to civil law. Thank you.
All right. If that be the case, no other comments or questions? Let's see. Who made that motion? Representative Hartman, I think.
I renew my motion.
That the House File 3656 pass and be referred to civil law. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
I still think it makes it out of here into civil law.
Chair and members, great birthday present for today. I appreciate it.
Right. Couldn't allow those to me.
You should have brought
two. So what are we going to do here? All right, so we have Junkie and...
No.
Is that there? Okay.
What are those things? What are those things? I'm not saying I want one, I just want to know what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Ground up popcorn that no one wanted?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Try it. Oh, come on, Ray.
Parmesan cheese on. Is that right?
Yeah,
some
farmers
did. How did you,
certainly
farmers eat
that
all the time.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of like
popcorn.
They both have amendments?
Yes. Boy, we're screwed up. It's like the heated.
I was adopted by the farmers. Thank you, my bride. Rolled on for what they rolled on in popcorn.
This is for
Did you get this?
Yeah. How many of these?
We actually got a
pension
board.
They
were entirely legal.
I'm trying to find a world. I'm going to be so
Apparently, we look at you, doesn't have it.
Hopefully.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Well, there'll be one, and to go through the woods, I think it'll be okay. Oh, that's very heavy. Oh,
are they going to get up there together, apart, or what? Did you guys flip a coin to see who goes first? Blank? Representative Blank goes first. Okay.
And he has the amendment, he'll go through
this. Mr. Chair, were you waiting for me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. My apologies.
Okay, that's all right.
We got the eminent Bilbane bill going on in the Ag Committee. Representative Junkie will be here. I'm sure we'll be here shortly, and I know he's got a bill that's very similar to mine. So, but if I can go ahead and start,
you might as well. House File 1838, and I'll make the motion pass as amended to local government. So you have an amendment here somewhere. Don't we have that yet?
Yeah, we
do. Yep,
we have.
I need to read.
Well, we can, if you guys don't understand it,
then we're going to do it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, does everybody have amendment? All right. So first, let's take a look at A061283, which is did you move it though?
Yes.
I moved it. Yeah, right. So, what would you like to say? Oh, let's see. We have a technical amendment as suggested by counsel. So, Mr. Burris, do you want to direct your attention to what your amendment may be?
Mr. Chair, members, as I'm taking a quick look at the amendment, I would like to recommend a oral technical amendment to the amendment. And that is to insert on page 1, line 19, after the term electric vehicles, an additional phrase which would read, comma, as defined in section 169.01, subdivision 91, comma. And that the intent of that is to be assured that neighborhood electric vehicles is defined in chapter 168A, because otherwise that term wouldn't be defined in that chapter.
You want to repeat that? 1.19 after electric vehicles, comma, what?
Mr. Chair, it would be page 1, line 19. It would read electric vehicles, comma, as defined in section 169.01, subdivision 91, comma.
Everybody have that?
Mr. Chair, I would accept that as a friendly amendment to my amendment.
Okay. Well, we'll incorporate that, and now you have your bill and your amendment as fixed up by the council. So if you want to address the amendment first, then we can add that in there.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think even though this committee's passed this bill before, I'm wondering if we should go back and review the bill just a little bit, so everybody's kind of got their memory refreshed with this, or if you don't feel it's necessary, I'll go right to the amendment. It's up to you. Okay, I'll go right to the amendment then. I just want to be respectful of the committee's time here too. To the amendment, lines 1.2 through 1.4, members, chapter 171, all this is saying there is that if we're going to allow for these vehicles to be driven in the state of Minnesota, that whoever's operating these got to have a driver's license. Section 3 on the amendment, lines 1.6 through 1.15, designates that we will license these vehicles also. Section 4 of the bill deals with certification that DVS will be able to have these vehicles titled. If you go to page 2, lines 2.1 through 2.4 is clarifying language on these vehicles that these are vehicles that have a gross vehicle weight rating of 3,000 pounds or less, and that these vehicles are low-speed electric vehicles, and that their maximum speed is between 20 and 25 miles per hour, and that this language falls into line with federal regulations. If we go to Section 5, is clarifying language that under federal regulations of Title 49 that these vehicles will have the necessary
safety equipment on, such as blinkers, lights, windshield, and that type of thing. Lines 211 through 213, operation. What we're saying with this amendment is that these vehicles will be allowed to be driven in the state of Minnesota on roads that have or streets that have a speed limit of 35 miles an hour or less, and subdivision 3 of section 5 is the restrictions and prohibitions on this by the Commissioner of Transportation that they still have jurisdiction over this.
Are there any questions or comments on Amendment 06-1283? Not, we'll move to amend 1838 with the amendment. All in favor, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted, and we now have the bill as amended and technically corrected before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What are we doing here anyway? Tell us about that.
with the bill now that this committee had passed. Last session, I believe that everyone in the committee has gotten handouts from Mr. Craig Letha, who's here with me at the table. Mr. Letha's company in Piers, Minnesota, which is in my legislative district, is a manufacturer, is the only manufacturer of low-speed electric vehicles in the state of Minnesota. His information or his handouts will give you a little more information on this. I think some of the members of this committee who may have seen and actually had a chance to drive these vehicles when the Environment Committee was up to Ripley, and then we took a swing over to Piers and got a chance to drive some of the vehicles. So I guess Mr. Dare, in light of the time and the schedule that you have in your committee, I'll just stand for questions now, and I'm sure Mr. Letha also would too, if there are any.
Well, Reverend Harrison.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I guess for the owner of V-Ride, this is really great, and I wanted to get a sense from you, you know, how are the sales? Is this catching on? And I'm very interested in plug-in hybrid technology, and so this is great. Are we seeing the growth?
Yes, we are. We're beginning our second year of our sales. And startup company, obviously it's a little bit tough to get going at first, but the more and more we get into it, the more and more excited people are getting about our products. We've actually, last spring, we sold one to the Minnesota DNR, and it was up at Itasca State Park all last summer. And they used it and abused it every single day, and it worked great for them. And we're hoping to get some more sales like that. So if you guys can help with that, just let me know. Thank you.
Representative Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rayner, I'm not going to go into all the discussions we just had in the environment meeting, but when I see that this is a 3,000-pound unit and it's a maximum speed of 25 miles an hour, I'm concerned that somebody's going to try to call it an ATV and create a new classification. Do you have any intention of trying to authorize these for driving on state forest roads or on ATV trails?
Mr. Chair. Representative Cox, no.
Thank you.
These low-speed vehicles, and for members who may not know the great history about this, and I'll try and be brief, but these vehicles are very popular in other parts of the country, and if you look on the handout that Mr. Letha gave you with the map, there's only a few states that have, in Minnesota and Wisconsin up here in the Midwest being some of the last in the country here to not allow these or failure to change legislation to allow these. But with our friends in the Southwest United States in And outside the state of Minnesota, these vehicles are extremely popular for people who don't want to go and pump in $2.50 a gallon gas into their car, and who do a lot of chasing around their neighborhoods, whether it's to go get groceries or take their son or daughter to soccer practice or drop them off at school. These vehicles are tremendously popular for those types of things. They're a very safe vehicle. Don't let those weight restrictions fool you. These are very soundly built vehicles, and I'm hoping that once we get this bill through this committee, and I'm not sure if we will end up going to Representative Olson's local government committee, but if we can get this to the floor, I've invited Mr. Letha to bring a few of his vehicles down to St. Paul for all of us when we hear this bill on the floor, and that let everybody from the legislature get a chance to sit in, and maybe we'll get a chance to even drive them around the in front of the Capitol a little bit. It's tremendous technology. It's a tremendous product being built right here in Minnesota, and certainly fits well into our goals of looking at alternative energy and alternative modes of transportation outside of fossil fuels. So I just love them. I just love them.
Let's see, Representative Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the author, could you tell me about the insurance requirements for these vehicles if they're going to be operated on the roads? What sort of insurance is required for that owners?
Mr. Chair, I think that is up to the individual here. If you look at page 4 of the bill, line 34, subdivision 8, the right to have insurance on this vehicle will be up to the individual, but I believe that they will be required to have insurance to operate on the highways.
Governor Stephen.
Mr. Chair, perhaps House research could help with this question on whether it is in fact required now, and if not, perhaps we could look at some language to add that, or I'd be happy to work with you, Representative Blaine, before it makes its next stop.
Next stop is the floor.
I don't know.
Or if that was in...
What are we waiting for?
You looking? Didn't you read all that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Stephen, and now I find where I'm supposed to be at here. If you look at page 3 of the bill, line 15, subdivision 2, lines 15 through 18, we do require evidence of insurance.
Yes. Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that that language has actually been removed from the bill based on the author's amendment, which deletes Section 4.
The whole thing is gone. From 2 to 5.
Yeah. Okay. Any answer to the question? I don't even know what the question is.
You may be right. Yep. Mr. Chair and Mr. Bruce, you are right. That is actually an oversight of mine that we accidentally removed the insurance requirement to this bill, and we will have to add that. We will have to add that requirement in.
Mr. Burris.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members. As I am looking at this, and I do hope you'll take it with a grain of salt because I'm trying to move kind of quickly on this, I believe that because this vehicle is defined in the traffic regulations, that it's defined as a vehicle, which would then subject it to the same insurance requirements that apply to other motor vehicles.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Blaine, I'm looking at the definitions of motor vehicle in the MOPO statute, and it looks to me like this vehicle, for purposes of mandatory insurance, would meet the definition with the exception of if it's required to be registered pursuant to Chapter 168, and I don't know if that's true for this vehicle. If it is, then I think automobile insurance.
Is that what you're saying, Mr. Bruce?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's matching what I'm saying.
Yep. So, the Department of Driver and Vehicle Services here, do they have anything to add to this discussion?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Larry Olola. I'm the Vehicle Services Program Director with the Driver and Vehicle Services. I first of all want to, I think, extend an apology here. As far as the amendment and so on, I know with this bill and also with Representative Junkie's bill, we've been looking at alternatives and different ways that we can kind of deal with this. With as far as the insurance is concerned, I believe that we're probably in the ballpark in saying that if this is a vehicle, then it may be subject to the 65D, but again, I think that'd be something we'd want to research a little bit more carefully. As far as the amendment is concerned, I think when we were kind of going back and forth, should these be actually motor vehicles, passenger vehicles or not, I think our department is pretty neutral as far as whether they should be a vehicle or not. I think some of the concerns that we have, or at least the issues that we have, is if a vehicle is going to be registered, we don't care about the amount of the registration tax, but it should be on a somewhat regular basis that the registration is renewed so that we don't get a vehicle on our record and then just retain that record indefinitely so that we know that this vehicle maybe is out of service at some point. The other thing is the operating requirements, too. Initially, the way that this bill was drafted, it didn't have the driver's license requirements, and it does, with the amendment, add that. So those were some of the concerns that we had. Just talking with some of our programmers today on initial ideas, we still have to sort out how we would register and show these different from other passenger vehicles if we did register and title them too. So we're neutral on the point of having to register them and having to title them, but if we do, I think what we want is a registration program that cycles at least at some cost. So.
You know, I'm inclined to call up Representative Junkie and lay this whole mess on the table till tomorrow, and hopefully that you can work out the details and come forth with one bill. So, Representative Junkie, would you like to come up now?
Mr. Chairman, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm sure it is.
All right. Mr. Chair, I have a number of witnesses, and we are getting a handout on what these vehicles. This is cool stuff. 35 other states have moved ahead with this. Minnesota will move ahead with this. Eventually, I hope it's today or tomorrow when we get this bill figured out. Members, my bill, and as you read through it, I have an amendment, too, that we can deal with. 2734 was drafted by by John Williams before he left, so unfortunately I don't have him here to talk about why he did things in the way he did, but essentially this is it. What we're trying to do is put these vehicles, and should do, into the passenger car category. These will be treated no different, members, than any other passenger car on the road. They have a vehicle identification number. They will be licensed on an annual basis, just like we license our cars now. We don't need to create a special category for them. They have to be insured. They have to be operated by a licensed driver. They are no different than any other car on the road as far as the requirements go. I want to make that very clear to the committee. That's our intent, and that's what's been done in other states. In fact, in my bill, and I believe in Representative Blaine's amendment, because I've worked with Representative Blaine a little bit prior to this and will continue to work, we reference the federal transportation sections that pertain to the requirements for passenger vehicles. And if you go into those, you'll see it has to have a seat belt, it has to have brake lights, it has to have, you know, front headlights, it has to have all the things that are required on passenger vehicles are required on these vehicles too. So my bill, just to briefly go through it and hit some of the highlights, and I certainly want to turn it over. I have a manufacturer here from Fargo that employs a number of Representative Lanning's residents, actually. And I have a dealer from a rural town here with me, and I have a dealer from Burnsville with me that want to sell these things and would like just a couple minutes to talk about their experiences. The bill, as you see, I think... other than the passenger vehicle section, which is where we want to make sure we put it in that section of law, not a special vehicle, not a ATV, nothing else, it's a passenger vehicle. I think that's important for the committee to understand. There's some, if you go to page 2, operation cannot be operated on a road with speeds greater than 35 miles an hour. Again, that's important. Representative Hornstein, be an ideal vehicle for South Minneapolis. You plug it in, it's electric, it lasts about an hour. You can go to the store, you can go to the church or the school, all on the South Minneapolis streets, which are all under 35 miles an hour, no problem. If you need to cross a higher road speed, you can. You cannot travel on it. You can't get on the highway, you can't get on the freeway. These are great for neighborhoods. They'd be good in Wilmer, where I live. In-town use, they'd also be good in retirement homes, gated communities. I mean, you can envision where these would be used and are being used in Arizona, you know, and around the country. I think the other important thing which Representative Blaine and I talked about is you also need to have a minimum maximum speed, if you will, and this bill does set speeds, says it has to go between 20 and 25 miles an hour at a maximum. If you don't have that 20 mile an hour minimum maximum, kind of a funny way to say it, but a minimum maximum speed, then that opens up the gamut for vehicles that can't go that fast, and you'd be plugging traffic again. And then that would be a concern of the police departments and public safety. So I think that's an important part of this the bill also. One of the things we're going to have to debate, listening to the last manufacturer, his vehicles weigh a lot more than these. And we had, if the federal guidelines actually set out a weight requirement on the vehicle, so we're going to have to determine whether we want to go with all the federal requirements or just leave the weight part of it open in our state to any weight vehicle as they come. But with that, Mr. Chair, I think it's best we hear from the manufacturer first so he can answer questions of the committee and then from the two dealers real quick and move from there.
Thank you, Representative Junkie, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jack Kennelly. My title is Legal Counsel and Regulatory Specialist for Global Electric Motor Cars, where manufacturer of neighborhood electric vehicles. We're located in Fargo, North Dakota, and a subsidiary of Daimler Chrysler. And we support the bill, House File 2734. My short presentation is that I noticed that gas is at roughly $2.50 a gallon. Minnesota Public Radio said this morning it jumped 14 cents over the last week, so I'd like to be able to end it right there. However, I did have some prepared text here. Neighborhood electric vehicles is a subset. It's like the electric version of low-speed vehicle. Low-speed vehicle is the term that the federal government uses for this class. And I was going to suggest that if you want to, and it looks like this bill is intended for electric vehicles, you might want to use that terminology. Neighborhood electric vehicle is a common phrase that's now used for these kind of cars. These vehicles are subject to the motor vehicle safety standards for low-speed vehicles, which require a maximum speed of between 20 and 25 miles an hour. They have to have headlamps, stop lamps, turn signals, tail lamps, reflex reflectors, parking brakes, rear view mirrors, windshield, seat belts, and a vehicle identification number the same as any other conventional motor vehicle. I mention this because I think it has to be made clear that these are not upfitted golf carts. These cars are designed, in the case of ours at least, they're designed as a street legal vehicle, and they're regulated by the federal government as a street legal vehicle and by the states that have enacted specific low-speed vehicle laws. They are clean and quiet and represent an environmentally sound answer, reducing the use of petroleum-based fuels and resulting emissions while meeting the needs of consumers for affordable transportation for short trips, which are one of the largest sources of automotive emissions. With an overnight charge on a 110 outlet, our vehicles are good for up to 30 miles the next day of driving. They promote the goals described by the President in his recent State of the Union address with respect to reducing our dependence on foreign oil. Although they're smaller in numbers than conventional vehicles, admittedly they are a niche vehicle, they serve a critical niche applications for individual consumers as well as businesses and local governments. We have sold them for purposes of police forces, utilities, and closed communities. They're also popular, very popular with universities, industrial campuses, and in Minnesota, I'm sure we'd find them very popular with the resorts and other commercial users. They're particularly important in non-attainment areas that have to reduce their emissions to comply with federal and state air quality standards. As I mentioned, they are not golf carts. They're not an unproven vehicle. In the case of our GEM cars, we have over 30,000 of them on the road today. And they're not necessarily a replacement for every car or truck. However, a study in California of 15 fleets with 348 neighborhood electric vehicles, they concluded that they replaced an internal combustion engine trip two-thirds of the time. Notwithstanding our support of the bill, I'd ask your consideration of the following. Well, I already mentioned the low-speed vehicles. The bill is intended, apparently, for electric vehicles. You might want to use the phrase neighborhood electric vehicles so that it's quite clear that you're, what type of vehicles you're intending here. In the federal classification of low-speed vehicle includes electric as well as internal combustion engines.
We're going to be running out of time here, so if you can, clear, we have two other people.
Okay. The only other thing was the bill currently requires the slow moving triangle on the back, and NHTSA last year in February of 2005, they were looking at what they called the conspicuity requirements of these cars. They were thinking of a change, and they said they don't need them because there was not enough data to support the need for additional conspicuity requirements on this kind of car. So, in conclusion, we certainly appreciate the legislature's interest in these type of vehicles, as represented by House File 2734. It helps to reduce fuel consumption and air pollution by encouraging the development and use of a new transportation alternative to meet consumers' needs for affordable mobility for short trips, while meeting the state's legitimate interest in public safety. They're part of the solution to a clear, quieter environment and our nation's efforts to reduce its dependence on foreign oil, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I just have a comment. And if Daniel Chrysler usually has some beautiful design work, and when I look at this, I think we ought to go back to the design board for the design. But anyway, can we get a few brief comments from the
committee members? My name is Bruce Brewing. I own a used car dealership in Wilmer, Minnesota. I've been very familiar with these GEM cars for, I want to say, since the late 90s. I've been involved with selling them in other states. I got in contact with Representative Junkie here about a year and a half ago. I had acquired one of these vehicles. It had a title. We sold it to a lady, and she happened to be from Wilmer, who wanted to use it to go down to the grocery store and get her groceries. We sold it to her, went to the courthouse, they took our money to register, and called us up a day later and said, sorry, come and get your money back, we can't title this vehicle. Mm-hmm. And we had to refund the money to the lady. She couldn't legally run the vehicle on the street. There's a need for this kind of vehicle. There are consumers waiting to buy them, and it is a legitimate, safe, meets all type requirements type unit. Thank you.
Oh. You want to wait or you want to know? Okay, Representative Nelson has a question.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a few of them. Representative Junkie, I suppose that this isn't allowed on Representative Seifert's practice freeway. But I guess I'm wondering a few things. First of all, what do these vehicles sell for typically? How do they operate in snow and ice? Second question, or cold weather. What type of impact tests are they subjected to for accidents? And then the last one, one gentleman talked that an overnight charge gives you up to 30 miles a day. Up to is the operative words to me, meaning it could be a whole lot less. So those are the series of whoever would like to answer all those questions.
Mr. Chair, maybe the Burnsville dealer who is selling them to people in Iowa and other places can talk about the pricing on them a little bit and where they're at.
Mr. Chairman, my name is BJ. I'm the Vice President at Park Chrysler Jeep. And we've been selling these vehicles now for about 5 years. Most of my customers are actually 95% of them are from Iowa. We haven't had any problems with them or anything like that. Now, what I just want to add is one thing as far as these vehicles are concerned. As far as the charge, it does last for a minimum of 30 miles. It's not, but depending on the weather, I mean, if it's really cold, it'll probably go down by 5 or 6 miles. But the nice thing about it, the battery is a nickel metal hydride battery. That means it can be charged at any time. It's not going to develop memory. It can be topped off like a regular gas tank. So any 110-volt outlet would work for that. Actually, I have one of my clients, what he did is, I'm not suggesting that anybody do that, but he bought a small generator and he put it on the back of his vehicle because it can be also there's a variation of a pickup truck. And he got it to go for almost 60 miles. So,
tell them what the cost.
Now, as far as the cost, it depends. I mean, on whether they want a two-passenger vehicle with a small bed in the back or a four-passenger vehicle. But the starting price on these vehicles is from $6,995. That's the base price. To almost at the maximum of $13,000.
What's the range on these at normal? At your normal drive speed?
30 miles.
30 miles, okay.
Yep, 30 miles.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, I did ask them about impact tests and then how they operate in snow and ice, and you alluded to the cold and the battery being tougher there, but How do they heat these things in the wintertime, too?
Well, as far as the impact testing, they're not subjected to crash tests. My understanding, and I'm not an engineer, but my understanding is the crash tests are done like at 35 miles an hour, and ours are 25 mile an hour cars. So they're not subjected to crash tests, and plus the environment they operate in are 35 mile an hour streets or less. And so they have not been crash tested, to my knowledge, at least not in the United States. As far as operation in the cold, it's going to affect your battery to some extent, and your clearance will affect your ability, I think, to run in the snow. I mean, our bigger markets, of course, are in the south, but we do have cars up here in the north. I know that there was a mall, a Brookdale Mall, the security people, I talked to them 2 years ago, and they said they had intended to drive theirs through the winter, but I believe they stored them indoors at night, you know, for charging, so...
And, Mr. Chair, they are licensed in North Dakota now in Iowa, and it's pending in Wisconsin, so they are operated in northern climates.
Well, we should really wait to be the last state to license these. We need to wait to everything else. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Junkie, ask you the same thing I ask Representative Blaine. Is your intention to try to include these vehicles for use on our state forest roads or on ATV trails?
Mr. Chair and committee, these vehicles will be used wherever you can use passenger car vehicles today.
Okay,
passenger car vehicles are legal on forest roads for logging, or they can be used on that road, but if they're closed to passenger vehicles, they're closed to these two.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions or comments? If we give you till the 28th, which is a week from today, you think you can probably consolidate what you two are doing here? And we can look at a bill that would satisfy...
Do you want it to match up with Senate bills that are moving too, or do you want to have that discussion later?
We can do that later. Just so you two guys get on almost the same page. I think you're getting there, but I'm not sure.
All right.
And we got that amendment, 2 minutes before we started here. And so I'm going to lay this over to... thank you for coming in. I'm going to lay this over to the 28th. That'll be our last meeting next Tuesday,
and we'll work with counsel on it. I'm sure he's been writing down everything we said, and he's probably got the amendment ready to go already. So, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Okay. Well, that's both bills, House File 1838 and House File 2734, laid over to the 28th. Well, we can worry about that. And Representative Paymar, did you gentlemen all sign up, by the way, on the list there of testifiers? Did you get them to sign up?
For all intents and purposes, it's equivalent, pretty much, other than registering. But they both have to be titled and traffic
rights. What the hell is the last one?
Did that figure it out?
I'll lay it on.
All right. I will move that House File 3401 be recommended to pass as amended, because I think we have an amendment for the General Register. Representative Paymar, welcome, and I want to pick up your amendment first.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to do the bill first, because the amendment is really sort of an add-on that...
All right.
If I could.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Transportation Committee, thank you for hearing this very important bill. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Lilly, and Hillstrom, and Nelson, Mike Nelson, and Representative Meslow, who recently signed on to this very important bill that we think is going to save a lot of lives in Minnesota. We know is going to save a lot of lives in Minnesota. Because of the shortness of time, I'm really going to have the students of Mounds Park Academy introduce this bill. These are just some of the more extraordinary students that I've ever met. Patrick Raines, Christopher Starl, Rachel Payne, and Michael Anderson. They're, again, from Mounds Park Academy. We also have a representative from LifeSource here, which is the Oregon Procurement Agency for the Midwest, and she'll be happy to answer any questions. And we have with us Gordon Tierney, who's an Oregon recipient who would like to address the committee also. So at this point, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn this over to Rachel Payne and have her introduce the bill and talk about the research that they've done.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the team.
My name is Rachel Payne. I'm a senior at Mounds Park Academy. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the legislation presented to you today is designed to significantly increase Minnesota's organ and tissue donation rate, which will ultimately save numerous lives. With more than 90,000 people nationwide waiting for a life-saving organ, and more than 2,200 in our own state of Minnesota, it is imperative that we do something to alleviate this crisis. Through extensive research, we have found that the primary reason people decline to donate their organs is a belief in common myths surrounding the organ donation process. It is clear that the best way to improve the situation is through increased awareness and education of the general public. In order to find an effective education strategy, we decided to look to what has been successful elsewhere. This strategy led us to the proposal we bring to you today, that 30 minutes of organ donation education should be required in driver's education classes in the state of Minnesota. In May of 2000, Wisconsin passed into law the Kelly-Knock-Reiner Bill, which requires 30 minutes of organ donation education in all driver's education curricula in the state. The Organ Procurement Organization for the University of Wisconsin-Madison now shows an extraordinary donation rate of 75.5%, 11 percentage points above that of Minnesota's Organ Procurement Organization, LifeSource. When questioned regarding Wisconsin's increased donation rates, Jill Ellison, Organ Procurement Outreach Coordinator at the University of Wisconsin, replied, "I think it's a matter of education. There has been an increase in the visibility of organ donation for a number of reasons, including legislation such as the Kelly-Knock-Reiner Bill, and people have responded. Statistically, much of Wisconsin's success can be attributed to the enactment of the 30-minute mandate. If you could please turn to Attachment 1 in the handout regarding this testimony, note the significantly higher donor consent rate among the age group of 16 to 19 years, which is the only age group impacted by Wisconsin's 30-minute requirement. I would also like to share a story with you as a little bit of anecdotal evidence of this bill's success. When my fellow students and I presented this proposal to our public policy class earlier this year, one of our classmates who lives in Hudson told us about her experience going through driver's education in Wisconsin. She mentioned that when the instructor said they were going to discuss organ donation, a handful of students immediately said that they would not donate their organs. By the end of the session on organ donation, all of those students left the class fully intending to become donors. If you would now turn to Attachment 2, you will find Minnesota's current state law, which only requires driver education schools to inform students of their option to donate. Any additional information is voluntary. According to Minnesota Driver and Vehicle Services, driver's education schools in Minnesota spend an average of 10 to 15 minutes on organ donation. A phone survey conducted by our group, which can be found by turning to Attachment 3, confirmed that there are schools spending inadequate time on this important issue. When students eventually register for their learner's permit or driver's license, they will be asked directly whether or not they wish to become an organ donor, and they must be able to make an informed decision. The knowledge necessary to make this important decision cannot be covered in less than 30 minutes. LifeSource provides educational materials, including a 10-minute video, free of charge to all driver's education companies that request them. Representatives from LifeSource have informed us that they can and will continue to do so should this bill be passed into law. Thus, the cost of implementing this bill will be minimal, yet the benefit will be great. Based on the increase seen in Wisconsin after the 30-minute requirement was passed, we can expect to see Minnesota's donation rate leap from where it currently stands at 64.5% to approximately 75%. The bottom line is that this bill will save lives. Every day that goes by without trying something new, the level of this crisis increases as 115 people are added to waiting lists around the United States. Every day that we do nothing, 18 people die preventable deaths. That is over 6,500 preventable deaths each year. For over 2,200 Minnesotans, time is running out. By adding a simple 30 minutes of instruction on organ donation to driver's education classes in Minnesota, we can help to end the wait for some of those people. Thank you for your consideration today. That concludes my testimony.
Mr. Chair, this is Gordon Tierney.
Okay, Mr. Tierney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Again, my name is Gordon Tierney. And the doctor said, you have 6 months to 2 years to live. It was these words that started me on my journey when I received my life-saving kidney from my sister Mary. And I was one of the lucky ones, just like Rachel has pointed out, that there's over 90,000 people waiting on a list to receive their life-saving organ. And up to 40 people can have their life enhanced through tissue donation, such as skin, corneas, bone, etc. In fact, I tell the students during driver's education that through organ donation, 8 lives can be saved, as I have mentioned. And I tell the students that they can make a difference. And their difference is that they make a very personal decision that when they die, they would want to be an organ donor. I tell them how important it is that soon they'll be asked, when they get their driver's license, soon they'll be asked if they would like to mark donor on the license. Because if they mark donor through a new law that was passed a couple of years ago, this law that was passed, in fact, through Jesse, the governor at that time, that if they mark donor, the doctors can then honor their wishes. Now, it's important I tell them that they tell their parents first, but still, this very important decision has to be made. Now, I received this new life, and I've done a lot with that new life of mine. I've gone out, I've made it my mission that I talk to students at driver's education classes. I talk to other classes, too. I talk to churches, any place I can get my message. In fact, in the last 90 minutes, one person has died. Maybe two people have died already, waiting to get on that list. That message is just barely getting out. And the way that message is getting out is what Rachel and Chris are talking about here. And that is to talk about classes. Now, it takes me about 30 minutes. I tell them these statistics, but I also tell them about my story that started out, I was in 8th grade, and at that time was found out I had a kidney disease called nephritis. Now, again, I was lucky. There's a lot of people on that list that aren't so lucky. Their turn will not come. Please give these students and let us give a chance to talk about this for 30 minutes, maybe more, about organ donations, because it's important. It saves lives. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, that concludes our testimony. I do have an oral amendment that was suggested, and I think rightly so, by Representative Fulberg, that will put an effective date of January 07, because, as she pointed out, there some of these classes can take up to 3 months to finish all of the segments of the curriculum, and that this could be problematic if we didn't allow LifeSource to get the curriculum to them, and this, if we didn't allow this time period. So that would be my oral amendment, and we'd be happy to answer any questions about the bill.
Well, are you making an oral amendment to your amendment or to the bill?
Bill, right? To the bill.
The bill, and what is there a space that we're...
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would just make it line 17 that
let council draft that. In the meantime, we'll reserve Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ricky Pimer, I'm not going to give you stories of family experiences with it. I do support what you're trying to accomplish. Do we have, is there any legal issues with a minor making a contract in of sorts by checking that box?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, Christopher Stahl will respond to that, and I will too.
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. The situation with minors is as follows. You need a parent guardian signature on the actual application, the driver's license application, when you sign it. The parent signature also certifies your decision to donate as a minor. However, even after you check the box and you're still under 18 years of age, the parents can decide to overturn your decision at the time of death. However, and I'm sure Ms. Larson from LifeSource would be happy to comment on this in her experience with working for LifeSource, that has never occurred. Moreover,
it goes the other way.
Sorry?
Most often I think it goes the other way by parents where the minor has not checked the box, I would think.
My understanding that cannot occur, that if you do not check the box, I don't believe that your parents can override that decision to force you to be a donor.
I think they can.
Okay, let's get to make sure we're clear here.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, I'm Susan Mott Larson, and I'm with LifeSource. We are the Oregon Procurement Organization for Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Can you hear me? You want a chair? It's okay. I can sit on the floor. The way the state law is with donation for all ages is that the donor designation on the license is legal authorization for donation, and we follow that. In the absence of that designation, we ask the family for consent and for authorization for donation. And you are correct that many times, especially for minors, parents will say yes because they know that in the loss of their own child, they can prevent another family from experiencing that same loss by extending the gift of life.
Other questions or comments? We have the Representative Peterson.
I just had one question to follow up, and I think this is a wonderful program. It's my understanding that some groups or religious groups have concerns about this or would oppose this kind of thing, and especially for curriculums I see in school. Do you have any opt-out, or have you considered opt-out, or do you think you need an opt-out provision for those families where they do not approve of organ donation because of religious reasons?
Thank you for that question. Actually, there is no major religion that does oppose donation. All of the major organized religions either support donation and encourage it as a generous and charitable act for their members, or they leave it up to their members as an individual. So there is not a standard religious opposition to donation in any way.
By the way, also, when I talk at classes, I make it very important to tell them it's a very personal decision. And, of course, I don't force anyone to make this decision. I really just tell them the facts and ask them to make a very personal decision. And first and foremost, I talk to their families. And that's the important point here, is to talk to the families.
We have the correction, or the proper language, I think, now from Mr. Bruce for your amendment. You, or don't we? Okay. Anybody else? Representative Lowy.
Mr. Chair, just want to, as we speak right now, my son just finished his classes. For this, he's 15, so he's on his way maybe to Maplewood City Hall right now, where the parents are signing that card. You know, they're signing my wife, parents. I'm missing in action. I'm here, it's just exciting that he could have that opportunity to change somebody's life, by doing that. I just really want to thank Representative Paymar for bringing this forward. and obviously the testifiers, and it's just really neat. One of the things that they included in their the packet, which I just think is so great, that there was an article in the Pioneer Press, and as a Democrat, I don't usually quote the Pioneer Press, but there's a great article in the packet tonight. I hope you take a few seconds to read it. But on the second page, there's just a really a nice story of hope here, and it talks about the kids, and it quotes Mr. Anderson. Which one's Mr. Anderson? And this is what he said. It said, this teaches us someday we can bring with us, or this teaches us something we can bring with us for the rest of our lives, Anderson said. You probably don't think about calculus every day, but public policy is different. We can make a difference. When we see a problem in the future, we can work to fix them. And I just think that's great. And that's why we're here. That's why we come down here as elected officials. And I'm sure that some of you will move forward. And I think one of them, one of the testifiers, is going to be a physician and helping people someday. It was somewhere in the article. But just really thank you for bringing it forward. And what a great bill. Thank you.
Everyone is here.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Representative Pimar, is it your understanding that this training will be incorporated into the existing curriculum, or will it be an additional add-on? I guess I'm concerned because I know that some school districts in my area have cut driver's ed because of education cuts, funding cuts, and so I'm just curious about if you anticipate there'll be any additional costs for families to provide this needed information.
Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Larson to speak to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Stephen, thank you. My understanding was to be incorporated into the existing curriculum. I mean, as Rachel pointed out, there already is a rule in driver and vehicle services that donation be covered. This would just ensure that that would be covered for 30 minutes of time so that there would be quality content added.
What about your amendment, 8C401E1?
Mr. Chair, I think I'd defer to Representative Severson. I believe he's the one who's actually offering it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's your amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Was it here 24 hours ahead of time? But go ahead.
Shock to the heart.
Make sure you write down on your door and start.
Yeah, I'll put that on my own. This, Mr. Chair, this is pretty non-controversial. This is, I'd be happy to slide it if people agree that this should not be put on. This is not to demean the bill that is going on, but last year we took a random insurance verification process, and we suspended the process because of a lot of issues with erroneous numbers coming back and people getting penalized unjustly. We suspended that and put in the bill until June 10th, I'm sorry. This amendment merely takes that June 10th date out of there and then keeps us from reenacting the insurance verification until we have results on that. And we're looking at getting some empirical data this month that will give us some of the information we need to do the fix. But we have not formulated that fix yet. We don't want to go up to the deadline and reinstate a program that was broken, and this merely fixes that.
Any problems with this report?
Mr. Chair, no. I talked to Representative Severson about it, and in the Senate Transportation Committee, they added this amendment, so it's probably prudent to.
Anybody else want to discuss the amendment? If not, all in favor of Severson's amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All same sign. The amendment is adopted, and now we're going to turn to Mr. Lewis for the votes. Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, I have an amendment written out, and it reads as follows: PMI moves to amend House File Number 3401 as follows. Page 1, line 8. After donations, that's quote-unquote donations, insert beginning January 1, 2007.
Does that work? Representative Hilbert.
Representative Piero is not on the committee. I'd be happy to move that oral amendment.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Amendment is adopted. We have now the bill as amended before us, and the motion is to pass as amended to the General Register. Any more discussion? All in favor of that amendment, signify by that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The motion is about, the motion passes and we're on the way to the General Register. Okay, one announcement. The next meeting will be Wednesday, March 22nd. Oh, that's tomorrow, my goodness. We all scheduled our HF 3398 Magnus, HF 3013 Smith, House Fire 3015 Nelson, what is it? We have the new number on here. We're going to do something, I guess. And House Fire 3718 Pine Street. Means adjourned.